Loading. I will thank all of you for being in the audience, including a number of you who I danced with last night. So I'm really glad you got up this morning. Hopefully you weren't too sore or you took your ibuprofen, one or the other. I want to thank the conveners of this particular session, and particularly Bill Miller and Lizzie Taroni for the invitation to address some novel outcomes of interest in STD prevention. I think when we were first conceptualizing this, they wanted to play to my strengths as a clinician. They asked me to tackle things like PID and disseminated gonococcal infection and how we might measure some of those things. I talked to Bill and Lizzie, and I said, I think those are really difficult to measure with some of the things that we have on hand within surveillance data sets. So I'm going to take a slightly different turn and go in some perhaps surprising directions, and also exhibit a certain amount of unpublished data to date. So here's the talk outline. Part one is going to be, I'm going to show off a few select novel outcomes of interest. One will be averting congenital syphilis cases. I think that would be very important and will be a nice lead-in to Dr. Sarah Kidd's talk in a moment. Two would be examining the care continuum cascade for the purposes of STD control. Three would be examining or re-examining, because Dr. Chow has already spoken a little bit about chlamydia repeat testing or repeat screening and why we might have such a tremendous interest in that area. The fourth example I'm going to show off is identifying those in whom it might be indicated to start PrEP. And here I'm going to show a study that we're starting to do with clinician identification versus EHR data identification, data mining, and sort of the IBM Watson approach to this kind of thing. Then I'm going to summarize and hopefully provide somewhat of a unifying framework. And from there, I'm going to ask the question how you might choose the right outcomes to measure and why you might have to make these difficult choices about the right outcomes to measure. Okay, let's start with the first example. This would be the beginnings of what we started to do in Massachusetts really in 2015 and this year. The prevention of congenital syphilis in Massachusetts, and there are those of you in the audience who will laugh at the numbers of congenital syphilis cases that we have compared to some very high morbidity regions in this country. We know there are tremendous disparities, but suffice it to say, for 7 years in Massachusetts, we had zero cases of congenital syphilis, and all of a sudden in 2014, we had to report three. Okay. Please don't laugh, just go with me here, but we were slightly horrified that that even broke through, and we, of course, did the drill-down analysis. It was only three cases. What's going on, how we might have prevented it, et cetera. And this resulted in this type of approach to thinking about congenital syphilis within Massachusetts. So we started with the pool of what we thought were new syphilis infections in women, 15 to 44 years of age, reproductive age, arguably, N equals 138 that we had identified in 2015. We moved this pool and subdivided it into those who were pregnant, those who were not pregnant, and I'm sorry to say we actually have eight women out of that pool of only 138 that we lack data on, and we will never know whether or not they were pregnant or not. Not a lot of pregnant women who had new syphilis infections. New syphilis infection. What's a new syphilis infection? Well, one argument might be a very new syphilis infection that would be of concern would be one that is primary, secondary, or early latent, because those are infectious syphilis cases that are likely or could be congenitally transmitted. So that will be the pool that I will focus most of your attention on. The other subset is we wound up picking up out of the pregnant cases, 70% of them are actually late latent or latent of unknown duration. What you do with these patients is an open question. I see Tom Peterman in the room. There are many arguments about that, but let's start with the primary, secondary, or early latent group. Only 14 women, but arguably public health combined with clinical intervention can avert some pretty serious adverse infant outcomes, right? We've spoken a little bit at this conference about the quality-adjusted life years for any infant who's affected by this and untreated, what it progresses to, and some economic calculations that could be done related to that. All right, this late latent or unknown latent of unknown duration group, I think it's an open question that we could answer about, does public health and clinical intervention avert any adverse infant outcomes, if adverse infant outcomes were even to happen in this group? It's thought not to be particularly infectious at this stage of infection, and so very little transmission is likely going on to the infant. So to look at, since in the interests of time, we don't have time to delve into each and every one of these cases, I'll just show you the infant outcomes from mothers with infectious syphilis, primary, secondary, early latent. So how many of these moms actually completed treatment and had their partners traced prior to delivery? Combination clinical and DIS field investigation data sets to identify the fact that 9 of the 14 had this sort of very complete picture. In terms of maternal treatment incomplete or partners not traced prior to delivery, there were only 3. Surprisingly, there were only 3. We were not really, really pushing, like this year, how we're doing it this year. Our public health nurse, Barb Coughlin, is the one who's really pushing this forward. Not treated prior to delivery, I'm sorry to say there were 2. But you have to look at these cases very closely and identify the fact that they were, at least one of them, arrived bump on a doorstep. She was high as a kite. She had no prenatal care. And it was because we identified her as having active syphilis infection at the moment in time, it was too late to have intervened before then at delivery. It was when we first met her, at least one of those 2. And I'm sorry to say that the outcomes from that, 2 of the infants were deceased. Around 20 weeks, they didn't make it. Oops, wrong direction. So I will point out that the outcomes of the infants from where the mothers were clearly treated and the partners were clearly traced prior to delivery, we did quite well. There should be no surprises here. I would make a solid argument at this point that public health and clinical intervention did avert adverse infant outcomes and healthcare costs. Here is an entire block, by the way, where one wonders if rapid review could result in additional cost savings at the micropatient level or the individual mother-infant dyad. Were we overdoing things when they received full evaluation? Full evaluation, by the way, in these infants may consist of only an RPR done in comparison with the mother's RPR. So full evaluation isn't the full court press like an LP in the infant. A lot of those were actually deferred and averted because the mothers were so thoroughly treated, clearly case followed, and the partners were traced. Okay, so there are a lot of questions about whether or not there might be additional cost savings here. And this, of course, was where we were very sad to identify that was, in fact, too late to intervene in 2 cases. All right, I'm going to move on to my next example. And you'll notice that I am focusing in a siloed fashion upon the major notifiable diseases in our surveillance database. So I'm moving from syphilis. Now we're going to talk about gonorrhea. Although I will tell you, Ryan Murphy's paper highlighted not only a gonorrhea care continuum for disease control, but he also did syphilis. But I needed a gonorrhea case example. So I'll just show you the gonorrhea data. So this is Los Angeles County in 2013. He published this, by the way, in December 2015, the STD Journal. And this is his figure 3, the index case continuum. I'm sorry, it's not going to show up well in the back, so let me just tell you, this would be the reported cases, the treated cases, those that were assigned for interview, those that were interviewed, and those that identified a contact. And much the same way we examine and continue to iterate and re-examine the care continuum cascade for HIV, Ryan's point and his colleagues' points from LA was, you know what, look, this is a great data display mechanism. You can look at this and you can think about the ways you can intervene as a public health department and identify steps in the cascade where there are fall-offs. What's going on here that we interview 45% but only identify 16% with contacts? Of course, we've talked about this during this meeting. You know, there are a lot of issues. It's not straightforward. You're never going to get back to that 45% bar. Or could you? And the point is that you've identified points that might be pressure points upon which you could improve within a public health department. He went even further. He elicited those out of the elicited contacts, which number were located, how many were interviewed, or perhaps an interview was eventually deemed unnecessary, how many were treated. Those thoughts were also on his mind. And you start to spur your thinking in terms of this care continuum cascade. Is it about clinical care, or is it about public health intervention care continuum cascade? And his bottom line was field services continuums clearly demonstrate areas of strength within the program, as well as provide key programmatic data that can be used to identify areas in need of improvement. Okay, I am now going to move to, hopefully I did this right, this is my third example now, and this is going to focus on repeat testing for chlamydia. This is the STD treatment guidelines in 2015. By the way, this repeat testing recommendation, in an effort to really sort of drill down and see when this repeat testing recommendation came out, there are those of you in the audience who have been around long enough to think about the fact that we've actually iterated about this in the STD treatment guidelines at least for three cycles, but the phrasing on this particular recommendation has gotten stronger and stronger over time. We ID docs, we like to pride ourselves on the subtleties with which we issue our recommendations. But this one is no longer quite so subtle. Men and women who have been treated for chlamydia should be retested approximately 3 months after treatment, regardless of whether they believe that their sex partners were treated. But this is a much stronger recommendation than it was even two cycles ago, because the evidence base has improved beyond just high-risk populations who are known to be repeatedly reinfected. High-risk, high-risk sexual network, sure, understandable. But we now even have general population data where chlamydia is concerned. Retesting the index patient who originally had chlamydia infection, that patient in effect announced to you that they were at high risk for reacquisition, right? So we have better and better data, and thus the treatment guidelines have strengthened in this arena. So we thought we'd take a look at this, and these are data from chlamydia test of reinfection, repeat testing within 29 to 100 days of infection. And these are data that I worked on with Mike Klompas and Atrius Health, Ben Kruskal, and a number of our collaborators under Sun B to examine this repeat testing within 29 to 120 days of infection. This is now Atrius Health combined with Cambridge Health Alliance combined with Mass League of Community Health Centers data, approximately 1.5 million patients under surveillance within Massachusetts. Massachusetts has a population base of about 6.5 million, to put it in context, okay? And what you'll see here is something that's not too dissimilar from what Dr. Chow showed earlier. So the pregnant women repeat testing, we hope there's an even stronger guideline that they actually get a test of cure during pregnancy. They're the only ones who still are recommended to get a test of cure. But non-pregnant women, just focus on this line, repeat testing is only in the arena of somewhere under 40% or so, the base being about 10,000 women who had index cases, who had a repeat test within 29 to 120 days. And the men, about 5,000 of them there, and they're not getting a lot of repeat testing, arguably, in terms of the percent of the cases that were repeat tested. So very interesting. That was the data that I just showed. I apparently forgot to erase two of my slides. I apologize. But these data were just presented in Mike's Thursday poster yesterday if you want to see greater details about this. I would argue that the bottom line point is we are underutilizing repeat testing as a tool for identifying higher risk patients. By the way, an ancillary piece of information was that we were over-testing also, but you can look for his poster for further details. On to my fourth example, PrEP indication identification, man versus machine. So here we are. This is a vital signs issue. We're wondering in Massachusetts if we can leverage this ESPNet platform that's translating some of the EHR data into separate servers at the site of the clinical practice. Okay, we're leveraging these nightly downloads to identify patients with newly diagnosed HIV, and we are interested in using machine learning, that IBM Watson approach that I mentioned earlier, to characterize their electronic footprint of these patients who had newly diagnosed HIV in this cohort of Atrius Health, this accountable care organization. We looked at age, sex, race, ethnicity, frequency of encounters, frequency of STD testing, results of STD testing, anatomical sites of STD testing, and we looked at a lot more. He had a screenshot of all of the variables that we examined. We looked at hepatitis testing. We looked at prior history of cutting or depression or other things that you could mine an electronic health record for if that patient is followed over time in the same accountable care organization, that being one of the limitations to this type of follow-up. We created an HIV risk prediction score using these machine learning techniques, these machine learning algorithms, with Susan Gruber, who was amazing. She's a statistician with the Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute that we were working with. And we identified patients with high-risk scores who have not yet been diagnosed with HIV, and we shared this. We hope eventually to share this information with the patient's PCP. So in very preliminary information, and I will tell you that Doug Krakauer, who led this project on our behalf, actually has a great ID Week abstract coming up. This is the preliminary data that we had, though. So this will be presented at ID Week later this fall. Distribution of risk scores for acquiring HIV, you can tell that the machine can tell us that there are actually some very high-risk patients. Out of the 800,000 patients, 1,200 were already diagnosed with HIV. 250 are currently receiving PrEP, and the active question that is ID Week abstract will address is, was man better or was the machine better? And really, is it a combination of both, perhaps? These are key candidates, nonetheless, for HIV testing and PrEP. So I've taken you through a number of novel outcomes of interest. They were selected to showcase the siloed approach to different diseases and the ways we might tackle our knowledge about them, congenital syphilis cases averted, gonorrhea, and syphilis field services continuums, repeat testing for chlamydia, PrEP indications identified by clinicians versus machine learning, right? Those are the examples. Let's think a little bit about the data that we used to generate the information that we drew some conclusions on, some very powerful conclusions, might I add. The data that we used, for the most part, were surveillance data combined with clinical case review, surveillance data combined with field investigation, electronic medical records via ESPNet for the latter two projects. So data that we now in 2016 in Massachusetts have on hand, or you could start to think in your jurisdictions about how you might grow and develop. What audiences are we developing this for? We are thinking about different audiences, and we have different ends for each one of these projects, right? You know, we have a tremendous partnership between public health and clinical medicine in terms of thinking about population health now. And clinicians and STD programs are probably the primary audience for the initial stuff. STD programs and funders, arguably, are surveillance data and field investigation, such as Ryan's data in the care, his investigation care cascade. Accountable care organizations and licensing agencies potentially are very interested in repeat testing for chlamydia. Accountable care organizations, and again, the health insurer might be very interested in this pool of patients, very high-risk patients where you can avert HIV as your chronic STD. To what end? Well, these are very powerful endpoints. When you start to think about these novel outcomes of interest, we could use cost-effective effectiveness analyses on the congenital syphilis cases. We could improve field services efficiency at the STD program level and do quality improvement there. We can do clinical QI and measurement and reduction of repeat infection for improvement in clinical endpoints. We might also be able to, in the future, develop electronic decision aids and improve the clinical QI related to HIV prevention and care. So what's a framework for selecting novel outcomes of interest? Could the choice of the outcome measure, I would argue that the choice of the outcome measure should be driven by the audiences where you want to present this information to. The purpose of surveillance is also part of the driver and or the interest of the group that you happen to be working with. If there are multiple audiences, the outcome selected must be of mutual interest. So if I'm working with Atrius Health, one of the first things I do is I talk to Ben Kruskal and say, what are you interested in looking at next? And he was the one who said, you know, I think we should look at this high-risk patient population that we should avert HIV and repeat STI infection. Okay, then. Feasibility can be an issue, perhaps less so if data can be repurposed or resources can be redirected. As you think about trying to make your electronic databases and electronic case reporting very solid and solidly related to essentially making that more automated, can you free up your epi staff, your surveillance staff, to start thinking about more novel outcomes? Time is definitely the enemy. I'll show you why in a moment. And I do have to ask the question, are we blurring the lines between public health surveillance and evaluation, right? But I will point out that our mission has always been to count cases of interest in a population and then do something about them, reduce them or increase them. And this would be what we would all consider actionable public health, right? So why is time the enemy? Because there is so much to choose from. And so many of you in the audience are already doing these novel outcomes of interest, I would argue. So Hillard has published quite a bit. I ran quick PubMed searches. Erica Samoff's group, Joan Chow's group, Sarah Kidd has done stuff. All of this is becoming published, and all the posters and presentations that I missed at this conference, I'm very sorry. I could have selected from an ocean's worth to provide you with the core examples that I gave you today. So there are just too many possible novel outcomes to follow. So let me leave you with my final slide, how we might do some priority setting. By who? So there is the grassroots approach, right? That's always one way to do it, the organic process. And there's also the top-down approach. The top-down approach is exhibited in this comic, but also if you think a little bit about the way we expend our money in STD prevention. Gail Bolden likes to throw up a slide of the pie of all the money that she gets to do everything in STD control in the United States of America. And with a grain of salt, as we all take Gail with, maybe a little bit more than a grain of salt. I'm just teasing. Hopefully, oops, I think this was recorded. Oh, dear. You can think about budgetary implications, right? So say you spend 60% of your program budget on DIS and field investigation. Well, then I would advise you that taking a closer look at Ryan Murphy's paper is really crucial because the efficiencies gained there will make a difference. So you can think about that as the top-down approach, the monetary approach, the very sort of business-dry approach. Or what we might prefer in surveillance is an appreciation of what our staff are interested in or what our colleagues are interested in. It's a both-and proposition, not an either-or proposition. And I'll leave it there, except with a bunch of thank yous to a ton of people, both in my group, over at Harvard Pilgrim Healthcare Institute, over at Atrius Health, over at the BI Deaconess Medical Center. Commonwealth Informatics is our key informatics partner for a lot of our ESPNet activities. And of course, since I just got done telling you, it's about the money. Sun colleagues and funding from CDC DSCDP through the STD Surveillance Network Part B, Sun B. A lot of the activities that I spoke about in Massachusetts, even some of the unpublished data, are from SUNB activities. All right, thank you so much for your attention.